Okay. Got it. Okay. I'm sure people will join. Right. Where are we? We're in chapter 9, Yechezkel chapter 9, and we're on verse 3. Just to bring everyone up to date, for those that missed last week. Yechezkel is having a vision of God leaving Yerushalayim, or starting to leave Yerushalayim. And in verse 3, we learn as follows. The glory, the essence, the presence of God lifted itself up from the kruv, from the cherub, asher hoyo lo, where it had been resting, el mitan habayis, and traveled to the threshold of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple, vayikro el ha'ish halavush habadim, and he called to the man clothed in white linen, asher keses asof of amosno, who had a scribe's tablet in his belt. Now, what's happening at the moment is Yechezkel is seeing a vision of Yerushalayim. He's seeing six destroyers coming to Yerushalayim. Who the six destroyers are is a matter of debate, as we discussed last week. The Gemara says it's six angels coming to destroy Yerushalayim. Other opinions are that it's not six destroyers, but it's six reasons. He's seeing six reasons. Particular reasons why the temple is being destroyed, why Jerusalem is being destroyed. And we got up to the point here where they're coming into Yerushalayim, and the six destructive angels, and one dressed in white clothing, and he's keeping score. He's keeping score of who's going to be killed. And we got to the point last week where I wanted to mention to you how Yechezkel is perceiving these people. There are seven people, six destroyers, and one who seems to be dressed in white. And how? What's the difference between the six destroyers and the guy in white? And how Yechezkel, remember, Yechezkel is perceiving this in a vision. This is something that isn't going to happen in Yerushalayim for another 5 years. Yechezkel is sitting in Babylonia. He's having this vision, an extended vision of Jerusalem, but it's 5 years before the destruction itself. And as we'll see shortly, it's quite clear that at the end of the day, Jerusalem wasn't destroyed by six angels or seven angels or anybody else. It was destroyed by Babylonian soldiers. So this is just a allegorical representation of something that's going to happen in the future. So where we got up to last time was we asked the question, how did Yechezkel in this vision perceive these people, these six angels, or these six men, these six destroyers as they came into Yerushalayim? And how did he perceive this man in amongst them, this seventh man who is dressed in white linen carrying a ledger around his belt? So the Abarbanel, this is where we got up to last time. So the Abarbanel gives us an insight. It could be accurate, it might not be accurate, but we don't know. So he says, Shahoyu Sheshes Hanoshim Ashchisim Shisha Malochim Mimalchi Yehuda. The way Yechezkel perceived these six individuals coming into Yerushalayim as destroyers, he perceived them as six kings of the tribe of the kingdom of Yehuda, of the southern kingdom, who are really these six wicked kings who were essentially the cause, the base cause of why Yerushalayim and the temple had to be destroyed, because of their evil actions that they introduced into their society, and their idol worship and their sexual promiscuity and everything else that was going on at the time. So he says, this is the way Yechezkel perceived them. Behe Menashe. The first one was Menashe, King Menashe, who was a king in Yehuda, in the southern kingdom, for 55 years. And he was a terrible Rosha. And his son, Amon, who reigned for 2 years, but he was an equally evil, not equally evil, but he tried to be as equally evil as his father, only Menashe was like a superstar in terms of evil. And Amon couldn't quite live up to the standard of his father. Nevertheless, he was a particularly evil individual. Joachaz, who was the son of Ammon, that's the third king. And the last three kings of Yehuda, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah. Also, three kings that didn't put an end to all the corruption and all the violence and everything else that was going on in Yerushalayim. So this is the way Yechezkel perceived these six men coming into Yerushalayim, these six destroyers, as being representative of the last, or six of the last seven kings of Yehuda, who were all evil. Ki hinei Menashe hu asher shot som ha-pesel b'heichel. As we know, we discussed earlier on, it was Menashe who originally brought a graven image, brought an idol into the temple, the Semel, that had four corners to it, and he brought that into the temple. But Elov Yachasu Hanavim Be'etze Barishona Churban Barishona Churban Yerushalayim Ulachain Osisi Mimenu Hatchila Lamalche Yerushalayim Eila. All these wicked kings, but chief among them was the guy that started all this trouble off, was Menashe, because he set the tone. He was the first one to bring in idols into the temple. Therefore, the prophets attributed to him to be the primary initiator of the countdown to the destruction of Jerusalem and the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, he stands at the forefront of the list of these wicked kings. But there was one other guy, as verse 3 here in Yechezkel deals with. He's the man dressed in white linen. And how did Yechezkel see him? So the Bible says, with Nation Moloch Be'emtzos, in the middle of these six kings, the last seven kings of Yehuda were all evil, except for one who was in the middle of them, and that was Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu HaMelech, who was a great tzaddik. But those who have learned Tanakh with me will know that he lived at the time of Zephaniah. Zephaniah was his teacher, the great prophet Zephaniah. Yoshiyahu spent the first 16 years of his life just like the rest of these six wicked kings. But then at the age of 16, he did teshuva, and he tried to turn things around in Yerushalayim, but of course he sadly failed. Says here, Barbanelki, who hoya ben Amon? He was the grandson of Menashe and the son of Amon, so he had terrible yichus in terms of his father and his grandfather. They were terrible, terribly evil individuals, murderers, pagans, you name it, they did it. And nevertheless, and he was Yoachaz, his son, and his sons and his grandsons are also evil. So he stands out in the middle of this crowd as a man dressed in white. Lochein horo shisha noshim mashchisim. The Yechezkel sees six destroyers coming into the city. Remez l'sheisha samalochim achronim shishchisu et Yerushalayim b'tov aseim. Yechezkel sees six men appearing as representatives of the last six wicked kings of Yehuda, who as leaders were responsible for the downward spiral that eventually would result in the destruction. And standing in the middle of this group was the righteous king Yoshiyahu, described in the verse, for ish echad besochom lavush badim. He is the man who's standing among the destroyers, dressed in white. Ratzalama tahor v'naki. He's the only one among them that is pure and clean. B'chol eis hoyu begod of levonim. And as a result of that, he's wearing white clothes, indicating his purity and cleanliness from sin. V'keses asofa b'mosno. And he had a scribe's belt, scribe's tablet in his belt. What does that signify? Shabbatoros Hashem Chefsim. The scribe's tablet that he had in his belt represents the Torah that he learned. That he spent his days Ubatoroso Yege Yomam Veloila. After his transition at the age of 16, Yoshiyahu's connection to and love of Torah meant that he was a scholar and he devoted his life to learning Torah. So, based on last week's shiur, the end of last week's shiur, this particular individual, there were six definitely guys who are destroyers here. Either they represent the six kings, the six wicked kings of last six wicked kings of Yehuda, or they represent angels, destructive angels, whatever they represent. The individual dressed in white is either an angel himself, as we discussed last week, could be Gavriel, it could be Michael, it could be the King Yoshiah. We'll never really know. And the reality is, it's really all guesswork exactly how they appear to Yechezkel. These are all suggestions. But irrespective of any of that, what follows now in the next verses until the end of this chapter is God calling out to the angel, the man in white, and to the other six men or angels with him that are destroyers. And he instructs them to destroy Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. And it's very, this next, what I'm going to say now is vitally important that everyone understands this. Yechezkel will see this via his vision. And he'll see the destruction of Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash 5 years before it actually occurs. And he's obviously going to see it in allegorical terms, with the angels or men or these destroyers doing all the destruction. And as a result of that, we're going to see his reaction to it within the context of the vision. It's not his reaction in real life, in real time. We're going to see his reaction in the context of the actual vision to all the chaos and mayhem that he's going to see. But it's vitally important that everyone bears in mind that this imagery is all allegorical, because 5 years into the future, when Yerushalayim Jerusalem and the temple are actually destroyed, it's not going to be angels or kings, former kings, or anybody else that's going to do the massacres and destroy, set fire to the temple and set fire to the city. That will all be done by Babylonian soldiers, as the Radak mentioned right at the start of this chapter. And they're the ones that are going to commit all the violence. That Yechezkel sees here, the angels, all these men, all these destroyers, all these guys that appear to be like wicked kings of Yehuda, in the allegorical narrative. So this is just a startling and really frightening set of images that we're going to see, but it's something that hasn't yet happened. And since it's an image and a vision and a prophecy of something that hasn't yet happened and could possibly, and it's bad, right? Because it deals with destruction. We know that prophecy and visions that deal with future events that are bad prophecies, prophecies that indicate destruction and death and chaos and massacres, they can be overturned. It's prophecies of brocha, prophecies of blessings into the future that can never be overturned. They're set in stone. So there's a slight undercurrent here, a slight backstory here, that Yechezkel is being shown visions of something that will happen in the future or might happen in the future, and they're designed to frighten the life out of him, which we'll see they do. Possibly in order to, that Yechezkel might be able to do something about it in order to mitigate what's going to happen, because he's got 5 years to work on the solution to this problem. Now, the reality is they are going to go into exile anyway, but how bad the massacres are in Yerushalayim and how badly the Babylonians deal with the Jewish people inside Yerushalayim, so that's not necessarily set in stone. So what we're going to see is worst case scenario. God's basically going to show Yechezkel the worst case scenario of exactly what could happen if there's no movement in Yerushalayim, if nobody does anything about their current situation. So here we go. Get ready for a rough ride, because this is one of those prophecies that really does take some explaining. Vayomer Hashem Elov, verse 4. God said to this guy, dressed in white, he could have been King Yoshiah, he could have been the angel Michael, he could have been the angel Gabriel, no one really knows. But God spoke to him in this particular individual dressed in white linen, in the vision that Yechezkel is having. Pass through the city. Besoch Yerushalayim, through Yerushalayim, through Jerusalem. Vahadvisa tov al mitzchos ha'anoshim ha'ne'enochim v'ha'ne'enochim. And make a sign, write a sign, the letter Taf, the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, on the foreheads of the men who are ne'enochim, literally means sighing, v'ne'enochim, which literally means moaning, al kol to'avos ha'ne'esos, Hanasos Pesocha. Make a write on the foreheads of these people who are sighing and moaning over all the abominations that are taking place in Yerushalayim. Write a letter Tav on their forehead, the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, of course, what's this all about? So the process of destruction starts off really in a predictable manner. God tells the man in white linen, who seems to be the leader of this group, what to do. And he says, Avor b'socha ir b'soch Yerushalayim. God said to him, pass through the city and through the Yerushalayim. Now, the first thing that should spring out to you is God saying to this angel or this man or whoever this guy is dressed in white, to pass through the city and pass through the Yerushalayim. Well, what other city could we be talking about here? Why didn't you just say, Avor b'soch Yerushalayim, pass through the city of Yerushalayim? Why does he have to say pass through the city and then pass through the city of Yerushalayim? So a lot of the commentators are bothered by this, particularly the Radak. It seems to be tautology. Why does he need to repeat it? So he says, "Vacha she'omer b'socha ir." After God tells this angel or whoever this is, the guy that's in charge of the six destroyers, after he's told them to pass through the city, he tells them to pass through Yerushalayim. Afal pi she'yadua ki ha'ir is the shezocha Yerushalayim. Even though we know there's only one city that's Yechezkel's only been in one city in this vision, and that's Yerushalayim, and that's the centerpiece of the whole story here. So why is he repeating it? Shari zocha be'inyan ha'parsha beis Hashem v'heichal v'ulam mizbeach. After all, the discussion in this section of Yechezkel mentions the temple and the different rooms of the temple. If you remember in chapter 8, we're talking about things that the doors, the gates and the Mizbeach and everything else and the hall, all relating to the temple. So what other city could we be talking about? So says Radak, Elohosif Amar Yerushalayim, the reason why God tells him to pass through the city and pass through Yerushalayim, Kolomo Ha'ir Asher Bocharti L'Shachin Shemibo. This is no ordinary city. Like, it is a city. Like, pass through the city. But just remember, this is for Yechezkel's benefit and for our benefit, that Yerushalayim is a city, but it's not just a city. It's God's city. It belongs to somebody else. And it doesn't just belong to somebody else in flesh and blood. It belongs to God. So it's my city, God's telling, stresses to this angel, whoever this is, to pass through the city. It's my city. And you should know that this whole episode is causing me, God, to leave and desert my own city. So and again, the Balei Musa points out here, there's a different perspective that people should have. You know, you go to Yerushalayim today, so it's a modern city. But the reality is, modern city or not, Yerushalayim has got something about it that's completely, even without a temple in it, that's got something about it that's extra special. It's the Mokum Kedusha. It's the centerpiece of the creation, the city of Yerushalayim. And in that centerpiece is the centerpiece, which is where the Beis HaMikdash is. And within the confines of the centerpiece of the centerpiece is the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which is where God rests. So the Balei Musa say, you know, people think, you know, they go on holiday to Yerushalayim and it's very nice and they stay in a nice hotel and it's very nice. And they do this, that, and the other in Yerushalayim. But the reality is that you're not just traveling to, you know, St. Petersburg to see the Hermitage. You're not traveling to Paris to see the Louvre, and you're not traveling to New York, or you're not to, well, you won't be traveling to Sheffield or anywhere like that to see anything apart from sheep, but or Leeds apart from, you know, morons. The reality is that Jerusalem has got something about it that's completely different from every other city. So that's what the Radak wants you to know. And of course, you know, the Yerushalayim has got this, the name Yerushalayim isn't mentioned in the Torah. The connection the Jewish people have got to Yerushalayim comes from the Nevi, not from the Torah. The word Yerushalayim isn't mentioned in the Torah. It's strictly our dreams of Yerushalayim, and our understanding of Yerushalayim comes from the prophets, not from the Torah, which is another shear with its own subject, all of its own. Anyway, so he tells him to pass through the city. Then God tells the man in white to pass through the city. While he does so, he should mark the letter Tav on the foreheads of the men who are sighing and moaning over the abominations that were done in their midst. In other words, to write a tab on the heads of the tzaddikim, who are ha'anoshim hanenochim v'hanenochim. Very well chosen words. These are the people that will get a tab stamped on their forehead. So the Malbim, who's very big on words and doesn't believe in similes in Hebrew, we don't believe in similes in Hebrew either, but we're not always got the ability that the Malbim has to differentiate between apparent similes. And the Malbim explains and translates these words so that you understand there were people in Yerushalayim that really objected to what was going on around them. The paganism, they were from Jews there, who objected to all the paganism. They objected to the immorality, the wife swapping, the incest, the pedophilia. They objected to the violence, the corruption, and everything else that was going on there. And they're described as Nenochim, Nenochim. So the Abarbanel tells us what's the difference between the two. Rotzaloma, Shehem Nenochim, Alabono Sa'om. Some people were sighing about the sins of the Jews of Yerushalayim. You know, they chat among themselves and they said, you know, like we do, isn't it terrible? ABC, you know, you saw so-and-so going to a wife swapping party. Isn't it terrible? Terrible. Oy, Trey. That's one group of people. Nenochim. Nenochim. Mipnation nil chotzim v'nenim al shebilti maskimim al masay yerushayim. Some people were actually groaning out loud. And they were concerned, that the excesses that were going on in Yerushalayim, they weren't that worried per se about what other people were doing. They were worried about how that would have a knock-on effect on them if God, so to speak, had enough of it. So the Malbim says, "Nenochim shenei chotzim b'nanim al shebilti maskimim al masay rishoyim." They're concerned. They felt under pressure that they would eventually suffer for the sins of the wicked people in Yerushalayim. So the two groups, one group, you know, were sighing over the fact that they weren't really concerned about what's going to happen to them. They were just, you know, upset about what was going on. Another group were upset, but for a particular reason, because they thought that they would eventually get punished for the sins of all the people that were committing these atrocities or these abominations inside Yerushalayim. But both these groups had something in common, is that they never said anything. But they didn't object. Lo mochu. They didn't object. They just, they were from, but they never said anything. But God says, you know, he tells this guy in the white linen garb, he says to these people, that the righteous ones in Yerushalayim, put stamp a taf on their heads. Because they objected to, as Malbim says, because they objected to all the abominable behavior going on in Yerushalayim, And again, I'll mention this again. I've just mentioned it and I'll mention it again. It's crucial, as the Melvin points out, it's crucial to mention, and it'll be even more crucial after you read another couple of verses, that despite the fact that these righteous people objected and they sighed and they groaned and they were concerned for their own safety, and whichever way they objected, nevertheless, none of them ever launched a public condemnation of what they saw. There was never a demonstration in the street regarding wife swapping. There was never a public demonstration in the street about the paganism that was going on. They objected silently. And as we'll see, as the allegory, the vision of Yechezkel continues, this silence of the righteous proves significant eventually. But at the moment, they seem to be getting a pass. So God tells this angel to pass through and write the letter Tav on the heads of these righteous people, but righteous people that didn't publicly object to what was going on. The Radak, interestingly, he compares it. It's an interesting comparison. The Radak compares it to like what happened in which is coming up this week in the parasha, right? And the story of the last plague, the 10th plague, which was the Maccus Bechoros, when God smote the firstborns of Egypt. And the Jews were told to put in their doorposts, blood on their doorposts on the night. And that was a sign that God should pass Posach, God should pass over, hence the name of the festival Passover, God should pass over their houses and just kill the Egyptian firstborn. So that was the sign. Anyone with a mark of blood on the doorpost of their property, so God or the angel of death or whatever it was, appears from the Haggadah that it was God himself, passed through. He didn't kill any of the Jewish firstborn, he just killed the Egyptians. Similarly here, there's a taf. This is a taf that's going to be written on the head of the righteous, so that when the destroyers in this allegory, these six destroyers come through the city, they'll know who to leave alone. And that's the idea here, says the Radak. And then we start to get into difficulties, because then the Radak quotes the Gemara in Shabbos, which is going to be very problematic for us for a little while. The Radak quotes the Gemara in Shabbos. There's a Gemara in Shabbos on Daf Nun Hey Omid Aleph that explains the process. The Gemara says as follows: says the Gemara, Maikuliah, what does this mean? So the Gemara says, God said, and it's the opinion of the Gemara, that this individual is not King Yoshiyahu, it's not Michael, it's not anyone else, but it's the angel Gabriel. And God said to the angel Gabriel, says the Gemara, go and inscribe a tav, the letter tav, in ink on the heads of the righteous, indicating the word tichye, you will live. And you should write it in ink on the heads of the righteous and on the foreheads, so that the six angels of destruction in the imagery, in the vision, will not touch them. And inscribe a letter tav, the same letter, this time in blood, indicating the word tamut, tamus, die, you will die, on the foreheads of the wicked, as a sign that the six angels of destruction in the vision will be able to recognize them and slaughter them. So that's what the Gemara says. It's not just a tav, a letter tav on the head of the righteous, so that these angels of destruction would avoid them, leave them alone, but it's a letter tav, and that was in ink, but there was a letter tav in blood written onto the foreheads of all those that were destined to be killed, all those that were destined to be destroyed. Now, this Gemara is very difficult for many, many reasons, five reasons in particular, but only three are relevant to us at the moment. And we're really going to have to, I'll discuss the questions with you. but we won't get an answer. Probably won't get an answer today. Probably get an answer next week. But the answers, the questions are extremely difficult. As I said, there's five of them. Three of them come out from this short piece of the Gemara. There's another piece of the Gemara that we'll learn later on, which will produce two other questions. But just as an advance warning, the questions very often you find in Judaism, the questions are a lot better than the answers. So question number one is, what's the real significance of the letter Tav? Why the letter Tav? The last letter of the Hebrew alphabet written on the heads of both sinner and tzaddik. Very good. You can make up the word Tav. You can make up the word Tichyeh, which means you will live, and Tamud, you will die. But you could just as easily use the letter Nun, Nichyeh, we will live, or B'chayim, a base. B'chayim. Oh, yeah, I mean, you could use virtually every letter in the Hebrew alphabet to indicate life, and you could find a similar word using the same letter to indicate die. Why the letter Tav? That's the first thing that needs to be explained. As I said, we won't explain it. Probably won't explain it today. We'll come back to it later. And the second thing on this Gemara that doesn't seem to make any sense is, once the angel is inscribed a Tav, a letter Tav, Tichyeh, in ink on the heads of those that are going to be saved, why was it then necessary to write anything, let alone a Tav of blood on the heads of the wicked, the Rishoyim? After all, if all the Tzaddikim had a Tav of ink on their foreheads, so when the angels traveled through the city, so to speak, they'd automatically know that anyone with a mark on their foreheads were not to be touched, and everyone else was to be killed, without the need for the Rishoyim, for the wicked people, to have any mark on their foreheads at all. Like, why, if you've got two groups there, one are going to be destroyed and one are going to be saved, so mark one group, so the angel knows which group to kill and which group not to kill. So once he's put a Tav, a letter Tav, on the heads of the Tzaddikim, so the angels know, these guys we don't touch, everyone else we kill. Why do you need a Tav on, why confuse the issue and have a letter on the heads of both? That's the second question. Again, that we'll have to deal with that later on. And the third question, which again is an obvious question, why is the Tav, the letter Tav, Tichyeh, which means you will live, written on the heads of the righteous, the Tzaddikim? Why was it written in ink, whilst the Tav, which indicates Tamut, that was written on the heads of the Rishoyim, on the heads of the evil people, was written in blood? Like, what the heck difference does it make what it's written in? Why should it make any difference? And as I mentioned, we'll have to leave these questions for the time being, but don't worry, we're going to return to these questions and introduce two more questions as we move along, after we've examined a couple more verses. So where are we up to? In the meantime, God's given the man, or the angel, whoever it is, Michael, Gabriel, whoever it is, Yoshiyahu, whoever it is, however Yechezkel is perceived, it doesn't really matter in that sense, because it's an allegory. But whoever it is in the imagery, in the allegory, in the dream, in the vision, God has given this particular individual in the white linen robe his instructions. So he's got his instructions. So now God turns to the six destroyers and gives them their instructions, their orders. Right. Now, long pasuk. Ula Eila Oma. And to these, the other six, the guys that are going to, in this allegory, are going to destroy Yerushalayim and all the people in it. Omar, God said to them, Ba'oznai, Yechezkel said, and I heard, it was in, God deliberately said it within my earshot, so that I could hear what he was telling them. Evru Ba'ir Acharov, you Vahaku, you pass through the city after him, after the guy in the white robes, as he's going through the city, marking everybody's forehead, either with the letter Tav in ink, indicating that they shouldn't be touched, or with a letter Tav of blood, indicating that they should be killed, the Hakum, and kill them all. Kill those those individuals that have got the taf of blood on their forehead. Al tochos einechem va'al tachmolo, and don't have any chus. Don't believe for a moment that these guys you're killing have got any. Don't provide any added value to the creation. And v'al tachmolo, and don't have any chemlo either. Don't imagine that there's a proper intellectual argument to save these people's lives. Which, as we'll see in a second, if these are angels, it's a particularly redundant statement of God to make to angels, because having mercy, having empathy, having sympathy, and whatever type of empathy, mercy, or sympathy it is a human trait, right? That's what stops humans from doing damage. Angels don't have free will like that. They don't have scruples. They just listen to the word of God. So the idea that God's telling them not to have any mercy, not to have any chus, don't hold back because you think this particular individual has got some added value, and don't have any chemla, don't you angel make any intellectual argument to support the idea that he should be saved. That seems very redundant, which is again something that has to be addressed. But they've clearly got their instructions, and in verse 6, God tells them, you know, there are no exceptions to this rule. Zokei, makes no difference whether he's an old man, bocho, a young person, psula, a virgin, literally a maiden, v'taf, a noshim, young children and women, taragu, lamashchis. Completely destroyed, completely wiped them out. Taragu, lamashchis. V'al kol ish asher olav hatov, al tigoshu. But any man who has got the mark, taf, according to the Gemara, anyone that's got the mark, the taf, of on ink on their heads, al tigshu, al tigashu, don't touch that. Umimidoshai tochilu, and you shall commence the slaughter from Migdoshai, from my temple, from the base of Migdosh. So they started the slaughter with the elders, Asher Lifnei Habayis, who were standing, who lived, who were there in front of the Beis Hamikdash. So it all seems pretty violent, and the verses, these two verses, seem to follow a logical pattern. Until you get to the middle of verse 6, at which point the whole vision, the whole allegory, the whole story, the whole episode that Yechezkel is witnessing allegorically suddenly changes and creates an esoteric mystery that needs solving. And whether we can solve it or not, I'm going to leave that to you over the next couple of weeks or next two or three sessions to see whether we've solved this this paradox, this mystery or not. So it may seem pretty straightforward, but let's go through verses 5 and 6 and let's see the instructions that God gives and where things start to go strange in verse 6. So we start off with verse 5. Ula eila oma biznei ba'oznai ivru ba'ir achrof. The overriding order to the six destroyers, which again, Yechezkel heard this clearly. God made sure that Yechezkel heard it, is to follow the man, the angel in the white linen through the city as he writes the letter Tav on the foreheads. Then it says, Vahaku, kill all those with the Tav, letter Tav in blood on their foreheads. And then, as I pointed out, it says, Al tochos einechem v'al tachmolu. The instructions to the men, to the destroyers, to the angels, is don't have any chus, don't convince yourself the people you're killing should be spared because they have a potential future value. Don't have any chemla on them. Don't try and make an intellectual argument that are worthy to be saved. Just do as you're told and kill them all. So this last instruction from God to the destroyers, Al tochos einachem ba al tachmolu, is clear evidence that this imagery, it has to be allegorical. And what Yechezkel is actually witnessing in this vision is a prophetically inspired metaphor or representation of something that will happen in 5 years, 5 years from now, when Yerushalayim will be destroyed by the Babylonians. After all, as I just mentioned, God would not have to command angels not to have sympathy or empathy or mercy on anyone. Angels aren't human. They have no free will or limited free will. They have no other option but to follow God's orders. The idea of God instructing angels to have no sympathy or empathy or mercy is a complete non sequitur. These concepts are not relevant to angels. So the moral conclusion of these words, al tochos einachem ba al tachmolu, don't have any type of mercy, sympathy, empathy, any type of feeling of regret about what you're doing. God is telling Yechezkel that when the Babylonians come and destroy Yerushalayim and the base of Migdosh, Jerusalem and the temple, God's will prevail on the Babylonian soldiers to ensure that they have no sympathy. They have no empathy. They will have no mercy. They will have no chus. They will have no chemla on the people in Yerushalayim when they come in with their swords. That's the first thing to notice about this verse, verse 5. The second thing to notice about verse 5 is just going back to verse 4, when God tells the man dressed in white linen, the white linen robe, to write a tav, a letter tav, on the heads of the righteous, so that they'll be immune to the oncoming destruction. The language of the verse is Vayoma Hashem Elov Avar B'Solchair. God said to the man in the white linen robe, pass through the city. When he's talking to the man in the white robe, God, so to speak, his name is mentioned in the verse. God allows his name to be mentioned in the verse. That verse is dealing with mercy, because what he's telling in verse 4, he's telling the man in the white linen garb to write a tab on the heads of the righteous so that they'll be spared. But when we get to verse 5, however, when God commands the destroyers to attack and kill people, we've got slightly different language. Ula Eila Omar. And to these, in the start of verse 5, it says, Ula Eila Omar. And to these, the other six destroyers, he said. It didn't say, Ula Eila Omar Hashem. And to these, God said. No, that was in verse 5. God's name, so to speak, Yud Heh and Vav and Heh, which is the God of mercy, that only applies in verse 4. In verse 5, you don't see God's name mentioned. It says, Ula Eila Omar, just to these, the others, he said, pass through the city and do the killing. So verse 4 mentions God's name in relation to be saved. In verse 5, God's name is absent in relation to those who will be killed. So the Medrash in Eichot picks up on this and gives us a general principle that God doesn't want to associate his name with evil. Now, this is something this is something we could talk about for hours. You know, God's associating his name with evil. What is evil? Why did God create evil? What's the need for evil? These are all valid questions, but they're not for us, our subject matter now. But God, so to speak, his name is associated only with good. And that's why regarding Yechezkel, verse 9, it only says, Ula Eila Omar. As the Medrash says, this is the words of the Medrash. Ula Eila Omar Elohim, ba'oznai, ein kesibka. Says the Medrash in verse 5, chapter 9, verse 5 of Yechezkel. It doesn't say to these are the six killers, these are the six destroyers, Elohim, God said to them within my earshot. Ein kesiv kan, that's not what it says. Ela ula eila omar ba'oznai. It said to these, he said, within my earshot. Evru b'socha yevahaku. The verse uses the pronoun rather than explicitly mentioning God. It's also a what's called word at the moment. A heated word, a hot topic, a pronoun. But we're using the word pronoun in the traditional sense. The verse uses a pronoun rather than explicitly mentioning God, so that his name is not directly associated with language of evil and destruction. And again, that's a hot topic, but it's not our topic. So that is verse 5, and that's pretty straightforward. They've got their orders. Follow the guy in the white jacket. If he writes a tab of ink on anyone's head, leave them alone. When he writes a tab of blood on somebody else's head, slaughter him immediately. So that's very easy. Now let's move on to verse 6. And this is where things start to unravel a little bit. The first part of verse 6 is simply a continuation of verse 5, and it's very easy to understand, because God tells these angels, Zokein, Bachor, Besula, Taf, Benoshim, Targul, Amashchis. The destroyers are told there'll be 5 general categories of people that are due to be killed, massacred, slaughtered. They'll have a tab of blood on their foreheads. Whether they're old, makes no difference whether they're old, young, virgins, children, women, it don't make no difference. Kill them all. Ba'al kolisha she olav hatav al tigashu. But those with the tab of ink on their heads, don't touch them. And that's pretty straightforward as well. That's perfectly fitting in with the Gemara. And now the problem starts. Because God continues his instructions in the middle of verse 6, and this is where it all starts to unravel. Umig migdoshi tochele, God commands them. And you, the destroyers, you shall commence the killing from my migdosh, from my base of migdosh. What did they do? Vayochelu, ba'anoshim hazakenim ashelifnei habayis. So they commenced the killing with the elders who were in front of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, it's possible, it's difficult, but it's possible to read this last command from God as being consistent with the rest of the verse. So you could read the rest of the verse like this, that God says, he's given them instructions that the guys with the tab of blood on their heads, they're the ones that are going to be wiped out. Good luck to them. Umimigdoshi tochelu. And God tells the destroyers in verse 6 to begin the killing like outside the base of Migdash itself. And again, this seems to be consistent with chapter 8. After all, what we discovered in chapter 8, we saw in chapter 8 4 visions of paganism that God showed Yechezkel, the Semel, the idol on the steps of the base of Migdash, the secret room where hundreds of people were worshipping various idols and carvings and statues, the gates where the ladies wept and worshipped the idol, the false prophet Tammuz, the place where the 25 men bowed to the sun with their backsides to the Holy of Holies. All these events and visions in chapter 8 all took place in the base of Midrash area. So starting the massacre there would seem appropriate. And furthermore, the verse then says, Vayochelu ba'anoshim hazakenim asher lifnei habayis, that in fact, God instructs the destroyers to start at the temple, and that's where they started. They started by killing the elders and the Zakenim. Again, this could possibly seem to be appropriate, as the Masilas David, one of the commentators here, points out, by Ochelu, Hiskilu lahakos meaz kenu she'omdav ne'abayis she'kotru leglulim. If you remember, during the second vision in chapter 8 of the idol worship, the paganism that was going on in the base of Migdash, there was this room, and all these people, hundreds and thousands of people, were gathered in this huge room, and they were worshipping idols, and they were offering incense to the idols. And it says there, Yechezkel reported there, what that part of the vision, which was the second image that he saw in chapter 8, there was every type of creepy crawly animal, the idol, everything scrawled on the walls, and all types of Satanism and paganism going on. Soviv, like there was no room to move there. It was everywhere. V'shivim ish mizikne beis Yisrael, v'ish maktar tobiyoda. And among them were the heads of the Sanhedrin, were the 70 men, the elders of Israel. So each man was carrying, was offering incense to the pagan gods. So if you read the last line of verse 6 like this, then verse 5 and 6 gives a consistent message that the destroyers were commanded to save all the innocents, as per verse 5, and then kill all the guilty in verse 6. And what better place to start the killing the guilty than the most guilty of all, the elders of Israel, members of the Sanhedrin, who were themselves pagans. And where were they to be found? Where do you find the Sanhedrin, even if they are pagans? The seat of the Sanhedrin is next door to the base of Mikdash, in a place called the Lishkas HaGozes, which is the Lishkas HaGozes means the building of the hewn stones, which was the building that was next to the base of Mikdash, which is where the Sanhedrin sat. Hence that Vayochelu Va'anoshim Azakenim Asher Lifnei Habayis. So here you have a perfect symmetry to the verse. Verse 5 indicates God telling the angels who not to kill, those with a tab on their heads, with a letter tab made out of ink, written in ink. And in verse 6, you're supposed to kill everybody that's got a tab in their head, on their heads, signed in blood, and start with the Zakenim, start with the elders, those who should have known the most guilty, those that should have known better. And the way the Matunas David understands this pasuk, that creates symmetry between these two psukim, and under normal circumstances would be the pshat, would be the simple understanding of the verse, and that's what's going to happen, that's what they did, that the destroyers came in, and they started killing outside the temple, and the first people they killed were the most guilty of all, were the members of the Sanhedrin that took part in all the pagan activity. But, the Gemara in Shabbos has a completely different take on the end of this verse. And this is where we really do get into a bit of a problem with the Gemara. And we get into a problem with the idea of God changing his mind, which, again, is that possible? Does God change his mind? How does God work in that respect? We have examples where the Tanakh says, for example, in relation to King Shaul, Nichamti, which badly translated means I regret making King Shaul the king. So God regretting? How can that be? How does God regret? How does God change his mind? God makes a decree. He must know what he's doing, or we presume he knows what he's doing. Why would he regret? Why would he change his mind? But here, and this is what we'll finish with this Gemara, which makes verse 6 stick out as a unique verse, according to this Gemara, a unique verse in the Tanakh. And this is what the Gemara said. And again, it's a continuation of the Gemara that we had before, where the Gemara says that the command to the man in the white linen garb was to write a tab, the letter tab of ink on the righteous, so they shouldn't be touched, and a tab of blood on the wicked, so they should be slaughtered. And now the Gemara continues. So the Gemara makes a statement that is startling. Never did a promise of good or beneficial decree emerge from the mouth of God that he later retracted it and rendered it into an evil decree, except with regard to this verse in Yechezkel. Says the Gemara. We read in the verse in Yechezkel, verse 4, regarding the apocalypse in Yerushalayim in the year 423 BCE. I'm just giving you context of the date. The Gemara doesn't give you the date. I'm giving you the date. By Yoma, this is going back to verse 4 that the Gemara quotes. By Yoma, Shem Elav, Avor B'Solchair. God told this guy in, dressed in white, go through the city. B'Solch Yerushalayim, through Yerushalayim, B'Tviso Tav, Al Mitzvah, Anoshim, Anenochim, Anenochim, Al Kol Tolos, Anasa B'Solcha. Says the Gemara, what does this verse mean? And we mentioned before, it means that the people who are righteous get a taf on their forehead, meaning tichya, and the people who are destined to be slaughtered get a taf on their forehead in blood, meaning tamut, tamus, dead. Says the Gemara. Now, at that point, there was a huge uproar in heaven. Right? So again, this is an allegorical vision that Yechezkel is having. And based on the allegorical vision that Yechezkel is having, there's a subplot going on upstairs as well. Because of course, this allegorical vision is representative of something that will happen or is supposed to happen or is presumed to will happen in Yerushalayim in 5 years, that God will allow the righteous to survive the massacres of the Babylonians. So, says the Gemara, there was turmoil in heaven. Now, there's a long piece on this in the Derech Hashem, which I'm not going to go into, certainly not now, maybe at a later shir. The Midat HaDin, which is the attribute of strict justice, said to God, in heaven, listen, how are the righteous ones any different from those wicked ones? Why are you saving the righteous ones? So God said, this is the conversation, right? This is the implied conversation. Again, part of the allegory. Now God said to the Midas Adin, God said to the attribute of justice, because I'm saving them because they're fully fledged righteous people. And those are fully fledged wicked people. So one group's going to be wiped out and one group's going to be saved. So the Midas HaDin said to God, listen, but it was in the hands of the righteous to protest publicly the conduct of the wicked. And they didn't protest. They should have protested and they didn't. So God said, yes, but I am God. And I have got perfect knowledge and perfect foreknowledge. And I know, I saw that even had the righteous protested the conduct of the wicked would not have paid any attention to their reprimands, to their rebuke, and they would never have done teshuvah. And they would just have continued on their wicked way. So the attribute of justice, the Midas HaDin, said to God, listen, God, it's true, you knew that these righteous people, if they would have rebuked the wicked people, it would have been ineffective and the wicked people would have paid no attention to it. But the righteous people living in Yerushalayim didn't know that. They didn't know it would be a futile gesture. And therefore, it was incumbent upon them to make a public protest as to what was going on in Yerushalayim. As far as you're concerned, God, yeah, you knew that it would be futile, but they didn't know it would be futile. So the Gemara says, and this is where the Gemara gets really, really difficult to understand. Then the Gemara says, God, accepting this argument, accepting this argument, retracts his promise to protect the righteous and decided that those who failed to protest would also be punished. And says the Gemara, that's the meaning of our verse. This is the meaning of our verse. Zochkein Bochur, verse 6. Zochkein Bochur Basula Batafanoshim. Originally, the only ones that were going to be wiped out were the wicked old men, the wicked young men, the wicked maidens, the wicked children, and the wicked women. Taragula Mashkis. They're the ones that are going to be slaughtered. But Al Kol Ish Al Asher Olav Hatav Al Tigashu. And the original instructions with those that had the Torah written in ink on their foreheads, the destroyers were commanded to avoid them, leave them alone. Then, in the middle of the verse, says the Gemara, God changes his mind after this conversation. God says, wait a second, I've changed my mind. Commence the slaughter with the outside the Beis HaMikdash. And they commence with the elders who were in front of the Beis HaMikdash, says the Gemara. After instructing the angels to leave those marked with a tab of ink on the forehead, the verse ends with the words, Vayochelu ba'anoshim hazakenim asher lifnei habayis. They began with the elders who were in front of the Beis HaMikdash, says the Gemara, Omer Rabbi Yosef. Don't read the words of this verse, umimigdoshi tochelu. Begin with the destruction, begin the destruction outside or at my Beis HaMikdash, at Migdoshi, at my house, at thy Beis HaMikdash, at my temple. Rather read the words, mekudashai tochelu. Begin the destruction with those that sanctified me, mekudashai, my righteous ones. These Makudashai, these righteous ones, are people who observe the whole Torah in its entirety, says the Gemara, from Aleph to Taf, the righteous. They should be the first to go. So, says the Gemara, what do we see? We see that not only were the righteous killed along with the wicked in the Babylonian apocalypse, but they were killed first, as they couldn't be bothered to rebuke the evildoers in the city of Yerushalayim. So this Gemara now takes on a life all of its own. Like God's having a conversation. Let me just leave you, because we have to stop there. Again, we'll review this issue and the questions that this Gemara raises next time, please God, next week. But the real big problem is here, I mean, among all the other problems with this Gemara that we outlined earlier in the Shia, one of the biggest problems with this Gemara is this. This. What is the Midas HaDin? What is it? What is it part of? Anyone? Where does the Midas HaDin, the attribute of strict justice, the attribute of strict justice applies to who? Who is it a part of? Anyone? Anyone out there? God! What, God's having a conversation with himself? What, God's gone schizo and he's decided to have a conversation with his alter ego. He's the beneficial God. He wants to save the tzaddikim. But he's got a man in his head called the Midas HaDin who's arguing with it. What's God schizophrenic? That we have to have a Gemara to tell us that God has this conversation with himself? What sort of a Gemara is that? And the idea that this is an occasion where God said, yeah, I give it. You know, I give it. You're quite right. You know, kill all the righteous as well. I mean, the whole thing is just too weird to be true. So what I'll leave you with is this idea. One second, let me just read it. So nobody tried to do anything. To whom did the tzaddikim object? Yes, they like we do. We complain to each other, right? We never go up to somebody who is Michal Shabbos before Eshia or you know, somebody who's wearing inappropriate clothes in shul. Churner, we don't actually go up to them and say, you know, here's a rat to put around. You discuss it with your friend. Look at her, you know, she shouldn't, you know, that's not a way to come to shul. And unfortunately, there's the answer. Thank you. The blood deteriorates. Erwin writes, the blood deteriorates compared to the, oh, we've not got onto that yet. Okay. Blood deteriorates compared to the, which is relatively permanent. Can that indicate that ink is being saving mark of blood being? Yeah, we'll come to that. That's all going to be dealt with later on. Yeah.
Rabbi, yeah. You asked this question like it's never been asked. I'm not sure what you got excited about, because from our perspective, living 2,000 years later, we see the Jewish people behaving this way over and over again.
Yeah. Do we protest?
It doesn't seem to matter. There are always some that do protest, I'm sure, but most of us go along.
Listen,
they do protest.
For example, you suggesting that we run out in the street and yell at people because they're on Shabbos? What are you talking about?
We've not got to that yet, mate. Mark, you're jumping the gun. That's your favorite game. You're a gun jumper. We've not got to it. The point I'm making here is the idea of God changing his mind, having a conversation with himself, and then, I'm going to save all the righteous, and then, I've changed my mind. Let's kill them all anyway. I mean, the Gemara is odd in the extreme, and the Gemara makes the point. This is the only time in history God's ever done this. So there's a lot that needs explaining here. As I said, we will explain it, whether it's to your satisfaction and to my satisfaction. We're going to need the Brisker Rob to explain this Gemara to us various other commentators who have got extreme difficulty with this Gemara, that the idea that God could change his mind and God could have a conversation with himself, and then you then cancel out a beneficial decree to save the righteous. What sort of a deal is that? But all will be revealed. I hope, I pray that all will be revealed next week in the next exciting adventure. Is will he, won't he? What's God up to in this vision? And what message is he trying to get over to Yechezkel? Which is the ultimate question that, we'll deal with it right at the end of the story. But that's where we are. That's where we're holding with this.
Henry, I have a small question. It's small. Yeah. Pasuk 6. It starts off with Zakein, Bachur, Uvatula. They're all singular, but Nashim is plural. Is there any reason why we switch from singular to plural?
I think one of the commentators refers, like, what have the women done? So it's specifically referring to the Noshim, if you remember in chapter 8, that were promoting the Tammuz, weeping for the Tammuz outside the temple. So, like, they're the first women you should be dealing with, the Noshim who were crying over the idol with the lead eyes that, they put the fire inside its belly and it looked like it was crying. So, I think that's a reference to them particularly, those Noshim, those women. Anyway, that's where we're up to. We're at a very delicate stage. I hate to stop us here at this point, but we're at a very delicate stage. But we'll pick up and we'll find out what happens. We'll try and explain everything next week, please God. And that's all I can say at this point, apart from Chodesh Tov. Have a great week. Have a great Shabbos. And thank you for paying attention. And Erwin, particularly to you, thank you for your email. I hope you saw my response. The point you make is exactly what I'm trying to do here. And people have a think. What about this? People, maybe you can even look up the Gemara. It's not Osir. It's not forbidden to look at the Gemara. Gemara in Shabbos 55a. Have a look at it yourself. See what the commentators say there. And let me know. In the meantime, have a great week. And I'll see you all, please God, in health and happiness, same time, same place, next Monday. Kol tov to everybody. Right. Harvey, you better get ready. Harvey, get ready. You got a show in 20 minutes.
I'm ready.
Okay. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.